Roundtable Osteuropa. Ein Podcast des Zentrums für Osteuropa und internationale Studien. Russia's war against Ukraine is now in its third month. And though the Russian army has not succeeded in its initial aim in occupying Ukraine, it has inflicted immense suffering, death, and destruction, with heavy fighting still going on in the east and south of the country. Since the start of the invasion, millions of people have left Ukraine to get to safety. In today's episode, we will talk about what is their situation now and how countries like Poland and Germany react to this development. And for this, I have two researchers who have studied migration and asylum policies for years, Karolina Łukasiewicz and Irina Mützelburg. Thanks so much for taking the time. I know you are both extremely busy these days. Karolina is Marie Sklodowska-Curie Fellow at the Center of Migration Research at the University of Warsaw. We were very lucky to have her as a guest researcher back in 2018, I believe. And we are very glad to have you back a second time on our podcast. Irina is a researcher here at Zeus, and she has been writing about asylum politics in Ukraine and the EU, and in her new project she studies the schooling of Ukrainian students who have relocated to Berlin because of the war. So Irina, today we want to focus on the situation of war refugees from Ukraine who fled to the neighboring countries and especially to states like Poland and Germany. But this is not the only and certainly not the first destination, right?
Yes, so the majority of people who fled the war in Ukraine fled, well, naturally via the neighboring countries. So we have some data of the respective national authorities about the border crossing. So we know that about 3 million people crossed the border from Ukraine to Poland, and almost 1 million to Romania, and then a bit less than 500,000 to Hungary, Moldova, and Slovakia, respectively. And a lot of people have stayed in these countries, but not everyone. But we don't know exactly how many people are still left in each of these countries, because not everyone has registered there. And then also several hundred thousand people have crossed the border to Russia under disputed circumstances.
Yeah, but what about those people? It's actually a pretty large number. Can we say anything for sure about those circumstances? So can we get information about that?
Yeah, so it's quite hard right now to get independently verified information on what happened exactly to these people who got to Russia. So UNHCR estimates that about 700,000 people have crossed the border from Ukraine to Russia since the beginning of the war. And on the 2nd of May, the Russian Defense Ministry actually claimed that about 1.3 million people have been evacuated voluntarily from Ukraine to Russia. So there are eyewitness reports that inhabitants of these areas that are or that were under the control of the Russian army have been forcefully brought to Russia. And the Ukrainian Ombudswoman for Human Rights, Lyudmila Denisova, claimed already at the end of March that about 400,000 civilians had been abducted to Russia, especially from the regions Luhansk and Donetsk. So what we can say is that during the negotiations between Russia and Ukraine about these humanitarian corridors, for example, from Mariupol, the Russian regime tried to primarily set up corridors to Russia. And the local authorities of Mariupol stated that several thousand people have been brought to Russia by bus, and they claim forcefully. So currently it's really difficult to know under which circumstances and how many Ukrainians have been brought to Russia. But when putting together these different reports of witnesses and authorities in Ukraine, It seems that people's move to Russia occurred under different circumstances or in different ways. So a lot of people probably lacked alternative escape routes to leave places that were under heavy attack. And they lacked these escape routes because the Russian army blocked them. So they were de facto forced to choose between staying in places under heavy attack or going to Russia, which cannot really be considered a voluntary escape. Then others seem to have been misinformed about the destination of the buses. They were told initially that they were going to Ukrainian-controlled territories, and only later they became aware that they were actually being driven to Russia. And others seem to have been abducted individually or as whole buses by the Russian military. And the Ukrainian ombudswoman that I already referred to before, they said that Ukrainians that move or are being moved to Russia are controlled and are like following this filtration. Some of them are brought into a closed camp in Russia from which they cannot leave. And this has actually been confirmed by US satellite images.
Well, it's very unsettling thought, and even the term voluntary is probably to be taken with care. The country who has hosted probably the largest number of Ukrainian refugees is Poland. Karolina, how is Poland dealing with the huge challenge of hosting this large number of people who are fleeing from Ukraine? Can you describe a little bit the situation of the first weeks maybe and how it has developed since?
Sure. So since Russia attacked Ukraine in February, out of almost 6 million people who fled to Ukraine, over 3.2 million crossed Polish border. And we estimate that between 1.4 up to even 1.7 million people stayed in Poland. And basically within slightly over 2 months, Poland turned from being a country of over 38 million to a country of 41 million people. This is really unprecedented challenge in the post-World War history. And when I describe the Polish response, we have to keep in mind that no other country in Europe dealt with such numbers in such a pace. Just within 2 months, the population changed so dramatically. So in the first weeks of the crisis, the response was largely grassroots and volunteer run. And the volunteers included just ordinary residents of Poland, including the Ukrainian diaspora in Poland and Polish NGOs who has been historically working with migrants. And then increasingly international organizations stepped in, such as UNHCR, IOM, IRC and many other, as well as local administration, businesses got very much involved. Higher education institutions stepped in as well. And then the initial response by volunteers included, for example, relocation of people from the border to practically around the country, and then hosting people in their private apartments, which is still the case after 2 months or 3 months in some cases, and providing food and clothes. There were all around the country's massive food and clothes drives. And however, people also started quickly realizing the risks of such uninstitutionalized help, such as risk for various abuses of migrants or human trafficking, or simply problems with coordinating all of those efforts of relocation and providing food and so on. And people became burned out. Many of them had no skills to cope with people who experienced war traumas. And so soon, as I mentioned, local government and also central government stepped in by first offering temporary shelters in different event halls or stadiums, and also facilitated relocating people. But the cooperation between local and central government has been a major challenge, and coordinating the whole situation has been a major challenge with, I don't know, some local government from, I don't know, a city of Gdańsk would send trains to the border and try to coordinate with the administration, with the central or the voivodeship of the bordering regions of Poland, but it didn't work. And they would like basically try to just, you know, arrive in the middle of the night or something like that and try to identify people who will be willing to go to Gdańsk, which many of them never heard of. So, I mean, it was a massive coordination challenge, and to some extent still is. A lot has changed after the government enacted the temporary protection status, the new law that offered 18-month access to Polish labor market, healthcare, education and social services to citizens of Ukraine. And I mean that it was definitely great in terms of providing quick legalization and quick solution to people who are currently in Poland. But on the other hand, many of them will not have anyhow facilitated access to applying for a refugee status, meaning they will not have these benefits and integration programs and so on that refugees has. So it kind of reduces the level of the protection they have, but offers a quick response, which is important. And yes, I mentioned housing. So we have data from different local governments, which indicates that, for example, in terms of housing, most of people were staying in private apartments, either renting themselves or staying with Polish residents. And that to that problem, central government tried to respond by offering a small financial compensation, and that was kind of considered quite controversial for the hosts, not for the refugees, which potentially also created some floor for abuses. So yes, this is the brief picture of what's happening in Poland now. And of course, I mean, the challenges are, I just mentioned relocation and housing and education, access to healthcare system, and pretty much every single service that you can, so public service or private service that you can imagine in Poland right now is stretching. It's estimated that we might have additional 800,000 children in the education system in the fall. So, I mean, this is completely unprecedented situation.
Yeah, and it is, you already mentioned the volunteers, but also the population at large in Poland has been very ready to welcome all those people. How do you explain that people were so ready to step in?
Well, very simply, you know, in the first day of the crisis, there was no alternative. And people were just coming, and took government quite a while to come up with any solutions. So it was just a necessity. And I mean, there were also a couple of, I mean, different factors interacting here. So first of all, I think vastly Polish society had a feeling of solidarity with the situation in Ukraine and Ukrainian people. You know, there is the shared Russian enemy, and also the shared history of have to fight for political independence. That's something that people in Poland easily identify with, and just simple empathy and like the necessity to help. And in terms of like the people who stepped in, who helped, so first of all, we had there were volunteers engaged with the NGOs that specialize in helping refugees and has been here for decades sometimes. But also interestingly, people used the grassroots groups that were established or initiated already in 2015-16, when Polish government used the kind of anti-refugee narrative, and then pro-refugee protests started, and some groups were already established there, and so the current response was building on those connections. And you know, just very simply, people, many people who are still helping or has been hosting refugees in their private apartments are just ordinary people who have never been anyhow engaged in helping refugees before, or not necessarily in any kind of social activism, and they represent all kind of spectrum of political views from right to left. You will find people willing to help everywhere in Poland.
Mm-hmm. So, Irina, what about the situation in Germany? And also, can you maybe say a little bit about how, by comparison to the influx of Syrian refugees in 2015, what is different now in the EU and in the treatment of Ukrainian refugees?
Okay, so I see a lot of similarities between what Karolina explained about Poland and the situation in Germany. So I'll be very brief on that. In Germany as well, a lot of the initial reception was organized by volunteer initiatives, and I mean partly NGOs that had worked in the migrant support sector before, but also a lot of new grassroots initiatives that just popped up. And that organized the reception, for example, at the train and bus stations, a lot of the translation as well. So I would say that by comparison to usual volunteering in this sphere of migrant support, there were more Russian and Ukrainian native speakers who volunteered this time than in general. And there were also lots of donations for emergency help. And the question of the housing is quite similar to what Karolina explained about Poland. And also this volunteering strength, capacities, enthusiasm has naturally decreased by now. So now there are problems to find enough volunteers. So in part, state authorities have stepped in, or also sometimes some kind of bigger organizations like the Malteser, like a Catholic charity organization that stepped in some places with paid staff to replace volunteers. But overall, a lot is still working based on volunteering, and the housing definitely is still a big problem for Ukrainians because they have been housed by either friends or relatives, but also by strangers, and often for a few weeks, so now they are really lacking accommodation. But to come to your other question about the differences between the reception of Syrian refugees in the EU in 2015 and now, I would say that, in short, Ukrainians are treated in a much more welcoming way than the Syrians in 2015, or actually than any other groups of asylum seekers that have arrived in the last few decades to Europe and that keep arriving now. So the first big difference between the situation of the Ukrainians that arrived and other groups of protection seekers is that Ukraine has had this visa-free regime for tourists already since 2017. Which meant that, in any case, all Ukrainians who had a biometric passport could enter the Schengen area without any additional procedures and travel around the Schengen area for 90 days. So that's already a big difference, which meant that the journey to enter the EU was a lot easier for Ukrainians than for other groups and a lot less risky in terms of migration. I mean, I'm not talking about the journey across Ukraine, which is obviously very dangerous, but the journey once they have reached the EU was overall rather smooth. And in addition, on the 4th of March, as Karolina already mentioned, the European Council decided to activate for the first time the Temporary Protection Directive. And as a result, a lot of things have become easier for Ukrainians than for other protection seekers. So this directive foresees that EU member states should facilitate the entry and the transit of the protection seekers. And this has happened. So indeed, since the beginning of the Russian invasion in Ukraine, several EU member states, including Poland and Germany, have suspended for Ukrainians this need for a biometric passport that I had just mentioned to enter the territory. And they have also lifted the existing anti-COVID regulations that otherwise hinder the entry of Ukrainians into the EU. And this directive says that EU member states can decide to relocate and redistribute protection seekers across the EU. But so far, this has not happened, in contrast to the past attempts undertaken to relocate Syrians, for example. So due to this activation of the Temporary Protection Directive, Ukrainians do not fall under usual asylum law, as Karolina already mentioned, also for Poland. And this also has the consequence that the Dublin Regulation does not apply. So Ukrainians do not have to apply for a protection status in the first EU country that they entered, in contrast to all other asylum seekers. So Ukrainians can choose in which EU country to stay and where to possibly settle down. And then finally, the procedures for Ukrainians are strongly simplified. So other asylum seekers are subject to very complicated and often very long procedures to obtain a refugee status. And for many people, these procedures drag on for a decade, and migrants are kept in some kind of limbo state for all this time. They are very constrained in their freedom of movement and their possibilities to work and to study. And in contrast, Ukrainians who arrive now can work and study immediately once they have registered via a very simple procedure.
Karolina, there has been migration from Ukraine to Poland before. Can you explain a little bit more about that? Where did Ukrainians come from and what status did those Ukrainians have in Poland?
The population of Ukrainians actually who lived in Poland before the Russian invasion on the February 24th and the recent migration is of course very different. And well, there are different estimates, but we estimate that there could be even over a million or even 1.3 million of people from Ukraine in Poland before February 24th. And this population were largely labor migrants, people active economically. And traditionally, they have been coming from mostly from Western Ukraine. However, that over the years and especially after the war in Donbas started, this trend shifted towards central and eastern Ukraine. Well, the migration from Ukraine has been predominantly men and people arriving to Poland without families. And it was also typically a circular migration, so people just going back and forth, crossing the borders for different seasonal works or coming for part of the year to join their families in Ukraine. And it's also important to say that this migration has been largely non-controversial in Poland, even though the numbers has been very large. So because of those many similarities between Polish and Ukrainian society, we haven't identified any like social tensions or this type of issues. However, the recent population is completely different. So that includes mostly mother and children. We estimate that there is almost half of the people who arrived are children or people aged 0 to 18. And they predominantly settle in big cities and central regions such as Mazowiecki Voivodeship. And according to the Polish Ministry of Labor data, there is around 100,000 people who has already entered the Polish labor market.
So we talked before about a comparison to the situation of 2015, and that's probably special for Poland to have taken a specific stand in migration policy during this crisis. Can you say something about that?
Sure. So since Law and Justice Party won the majority in parliamentary election in 2015, Polish government have been taking multiple anti-refugee steps, including pushbacks of people who wanted to apply for asylum in Poland and reducing financing for non-governmental organizations. Yeah, I think these two are the most important. And in terms of the pushback, so there have been many various NGOs and international organizations have reported that people trying to file asylum claims at Polish border have been repeatedly denied their rights. And it ended up with the cases in the European Court of Human Rights, which still has not changed or impacted, sadly, the government response. And the financing for NGOs was also a big issue. And especially right now, because those NGOs serving migrants play a critical role in the current response to the crisis, and they have been struggling to survive since 2016 with the reduced funds, because the Polish government has been distributing different EU funds to the local administration or to the NGOs, and those funds has been blocked or limited, or out of the blue some new organizations who never served migrants and were recently established would get the money to do those services. And the situation has been, like, over the years since 2015, has been escalating until the summer of 2021, when a couple thousands of usually black and brown people from Afghanistan, Syria and Central African countries have been trapped at the border between Poland and Belarus. And then the government's narrative was that Poland does not have the infrastructure to help that many migrants, and that the country cannot conform with Lukashenko using migrants as weapons and so on, which already then wasn't really true, because in the past Poland has been accepting yearly up to 15,000 new asylum claims, and there were people and there were places in reception centers for those people. But anyway, that was the narrative from last summer. And then in November, government started enacted a new law to start building a wall on Polish-Belarusian border. And the situation, sadly, has not changed much since then. A couple of days ago, I participated in local government roundtable to discuss the current response to the crisis. And the most moving moment of that event was a talk of mayor of a small city at the Polish-Belarusian border, who was in extremely dramatic words asking if we don't want to help people, and often also mothers and children who are trapped in this forest. So please, as a minimum, let's not penalize residents of his town who are helping at the border. And this is actually what is unfortunately still happening there, that people are arrested and end up in courts for helping migrants there at the Polish-Belarusian border. It's happening right now as we talk. An interesting shift here is the response of Polish courts, who in recent several cases has been actually finding people not guilty of breaking the law for helping migrants, and found the response of Polish border guards inaccurate. So that's what's happening with the Polish-Belarusian border. At the same time, once the crisis in Ukraine started in February 24th, following the arrival of the now over 3 million people, who are usually white, often Christians, the government radically shifted the narrative, and now the narrative was that we need to help, and that's it. But clearly, there are two categories of refugees: those deserving and less deserving, and the ones at the Ukrainian borders are those deserving our help, and at the Polish-Belarusian border, the opposite. So at the same time, despite framing this pro-migrant narrative, central government was still not as quick, and still is not as quick in responding to the crisis as the civil society, or just or Ukrainian diaspora in Poland, or regular residents of the country.
Thank you, Karolina. It's really a very stark contrast. I was actually going to ask whether this could be a turning point in migration policy. Does not look like that at the moment in Poland, but maybe for the EU, Irina, some hope that this response to the current Ukrainian immigration could be a turning point.
Yeah, it's really hard to say. So there could be the optimistic answer, which would be that the currently more welcoming treatment of Ukrainian refugees could serve as an example for the treatment of other groups, that it shows what is actually possible, that it shows that less bureaucratic procedures are possible, that more freedom for the migrants is possible, for example, that if you let people choose their destination and where to settle down, that they actually do spread out, that they go to places where they have relatives and friends, or that they go to places where there's work, which is actually somehow a natural way of distributing them, which actually helps them arrive and settle down, facilitates also the situation of the public authorities, because families and friends take over part of the housing, of the advice, of job search, and so on. But I'm afraid that this might be a little too hopeful when looking at the gloomy developments of European asylum policies of the last few decades. And also, I'm afraid we need to see and wait how the treatment of the Ukrainians evolves over time, which is not guaranteed to stay as welcoming as it is now. If we remember that the initial treatment of Syrian asylum seekers in Germany, for example, was a lot more welcoming at the beginning and then also turned out to be less welcoming in the long term. So I'm afraid the treatment of Ukrainians might remain an exception, because the measures that have been put in place are exceptional in type, in their legal nature, and they have not affected overall asylum laws and policies because of this activation of the Temporary Protection Directive. So for now, there haven't been any fundamental shifts in general asylum policies, and they have also not been really discussed at EU level. And for now, there is this exceptional treatment of Ukrainians, which, as Karolina has already mentioned, of this, yet also this different attitude among the society, but also among politicians towards Ukrainians. I would add to this criticism of, well, let's say racism in these double standards, that there is also the difference in terms of coverage of the Ukraine war by comparison to other wars that take place all over the world and that affect how politicians and the larger public react to Ukrainians who arrive, that there's this feeling of proximity of the war and the feeling that Ukrainians are defending European security and defending the future of Europe in opposition to this shared enemy that is Russia. So I think all this means that it's not so likely that overall asylum policies in the EU will change now, but this is a bit more of a pessimistic vision. And then I would add that right now other asylum seekers are actually rather suffering in a way from the arrival of Ukrainian protection seekers, because, for example, other asylum seekers are being evicted from reception centers to quickly make space for Ukrainians who arrive, to help Ukrainians quickly. So overall, there's rather the fear that there might be this feeling of, we have already done so much for some group of migrants who arrived, so we don't need to support the others that much anymore.
Yes, and I can actually, just to plug in, I completely agree about the first not bright future in terms of welcoming treatment or of refugees. I also think, just like Irina gave the example of Germany, I think in Poland it's already starting, and the initial enthusiasm to help is slowly being replaced with first frustration and possibly negative treatment or biases in future. You know, in Poland, people suddenly see Ukrainian citizens everywhere, at the doctor's offices, at the banks, in every public institution, and sometimes the cases they're dealing with are indeed longer. It's like, you know, your initial visit at the doctor for the first time takes longer, but because we don't have any kind of social media or government information campaign, the frustration starts and people think that we keep on hearing voices that now that you know, Ukrainian gets first place in the doctor's offices, which is not true, but this is a kind of feeling that is growing. Or recently we heard in Warsaw how some parents are becoming frustrated that we've been asking for so many years to increase the number of kindergarten places, which was, and we heard it's not possible, and now it is. So how is it possible? So I think this kind of frustration, feelings of frustrations in Polish society will be growing. And just to add what Irina said about the EU protection system, I'm also, well, maybe not critical, but I'm worried what's going to happen in the future with this system. The temporary protection mechanism, on the one hand, is great for providing this kind of stability to people's life relatively quickly, but what happens after the 18 months? And actually, this TPS status has been used for quite a while in the United States, and from this American example, we can see that it actually has its risks or generates some risks as well when the situation, war or other conflicts protract and keeps on going, and people still needs to stay, and they stay without clear path to citizenship or long-term options to regularize their stay. So there are some possible risks as well, not to mention weakening the standards of protection and not getting integration programs. Right now in Poland, we have discussions like, okay, people should have access to learning Polish, but how, I mean, it's natural for refugees who get access to Polish classes in through integration programs that they have, but since Ukrainian refugees don't get this protection, so we don't really have a system of providing classes, and not to mention in such a scale. So there is a lot of issues with this faster but also weaker form of protection.
Thank you, Karolina. I'm afraid we have to conclude here, even with this rather pessimistic outlook, but thanks anyway for taking part and sharing your knowledge and your assessment, Irina and Karolina. And thanks everyone for listening in to this episode of Roundtable Eastern Europe. Until next time.
Thank you very much for inviting me and arranging this podcast.